Thank you, Darrell. Today we've talked in previous blog casts about SMB1 as well as the SMB2. The talk for today focuses on changes in SMB2.1, which is shipping now in Win 7. If you guys have any questions on anything within scope within SMB1 or SMB2 as well, you can feel free to ask them either at the end of the talk when we have question time or else just to find the various people afterwards. There's several representatives from our team. There's Matthew back in the corner who's worked in the client for well over 5 years now, and there's Kibo, and then Gary is here as well as Paul, who knows about the offline files, transparent caching, and Vortex stuff. So definitely take advantage of the people while they're here, and we can go ahead and get started. So for SMB 2.1, there was several goals that we were pushing along for areas that we wanted to improve. So some of them included continuing some of the WAN or branch office improvements that were done in the Vista timeframe. And then there were some other things around application support where there were specific scenarios of various size that we wanted to enable or investigate. And also, as we see 10 gigabit Ethernet starting to make more inroads into deployments in sort of enterprise areas, we wanted to investigate if there were possibilities to tune the protocol to take better advantage of available bandwidth when it reaches those high levels. And then there were a couple of things along with Windows 7, separate from specifically the protocol, that were targeted, such as improving our interaction with power management, like sleep states on the client and on the server, and some other specific issues. So through the talk, what we'll do first is we'll walk through specifically the SMB 2.1 protocol changes, and then after that, we'll actually touch on some of the Windows 7 client behavior you might see if you have an SMB 2 implementation that was done as well. The first place to start is actually in line with protocol negotiation. One of the things we realized quickly is that if we wanted to introduce multiple dialects within SMB2, that we would continue growing the SMB1 multiple protocol negotiate string that has all the legacy dialects and NTLM 0.12 as long as SMB2.002, and we didn't want to keep doing that indefinitely. And another interesting thing is that if there are fields within the SMB2 negotiate request, such as the capabilities that the client provides, we can't actually take advantage of it unless we actually see an SMB2 negotiate request. So we need a way, if a client's doing a multi-protocol negotiate that could go either SMB1 or SMB2, we need a way to say, yes, we are SMB2, but we want to do a full SMB2 negotiate. What was actually introduced is a new dialect in the multi-protocol negotiate string, which is 2.?? And that's an indication from the client. You'll see it over here on the upper right in the first SMB negotiate that says, yes, I support SMB2 dialects. And if the server sees that, he'll actually respond selecting the dialect as basically 2FF, which means I'm selecting an SMB2 dialect, and then the client will then do another round trip supplying an SMB2 negotiate request as defined in the protocol, offering the array of dialects that they want to choose from. In this case, there's 2.002 and there's 2.1. And in this way, when the client sends that negotiate, the server actually receives the client's capabilities, the client GUID, and anything else that might be contained in the SMB2 negotiate request that isn't equivalent in the SMB1 negotiate request. And then when the server responds to that, then the dialect selection is completed, and everything else related to processing would continue as normal with SMB2. So, regarding 10 gigabit Ethernet, yes, sorry. So the question is, if you have the registry parameter set to disable SMB, does it still begin with the, you mean the SMB negotiate that has all the different strings? Or which frame? Yeah, so our client implementation, if you stop the SMB2 mini redirector, will still actually start off with a multi-protocol string. It's just that the various other values, like the PC network and LM1, all the way up to NTLM 0.12, won't be present in the string. So it'll send an SMB1 negotiate that just has SMB2.002, and in this case, SMB2.?? And then if it's an SMB1 server, it'll essentially fail to negotiate because it doesn't find the appropriate dialect. So, yes? Yes, and that would be the normal case. Like if you had for example, with us, if you had our Win 7 client talking to a server 2008 R2 server, we'll send this providing both 2.002 and 2.?? And the server, since he's not aware of the new dialect string, will just accept 2.002, and processing continues just as you see on Vista. So, any other questions?
Is there any way to start directly on SMB2 on the bus 2 and skip bus 1?
From a client implementation, if you're not trying to be compatible with SMB1, then you should just be able to start directly here. That's true. Yes, and that's fully valid. In fact, with our client, if you've connected in the past to a server, there's basically the equivalent of a small cache where we know what dialect was negotiated. And if you go disconnected and you're reconnecting to that server, we'll essentially jump in right with an SMB2 negotiate because we already know it. But if we've never talked to a server before, we start at the top. And the fact that we start at the top, even if SMB1 is disabled, is purely like a side effect of how we've implemented the protocol selection across our drivers. There's no reason if you don't do SMB1 at all that you shouldn't just always start with an SMB2 negotiate. So, and in fact, in this case, it would save you a round trip. Yes?
On that client cache note, for testing, is there a way to easily plug
that? I called it a cache. Really what it is that if there are opens to a file or like a map drive or something that holds a reference to our structures such that we can't free them or release them, then essentially the dialect gets pinned. And there's not really a way to force it because we can't forcibly tear down those objects. So the most common case is that I map a drive to your server, and then my drive goes disconnected, but the drive mapping still exists on the client, and that's pinning down the SMB1 or SMB2 dialect. And now if you have a way to dynamically turn on and off dialects on your server, you turn off SMB2, but now when I try to reconnect the disconnected drive, I get a failure because I'm only going to try SMB2. So that issue existed in Vista, and it will still exist in Win 7. The only absolutely positive way to force it to clear all those references would be to either log everyone off the system so that you know everything gets torn down or reboot the system. Now, that being said, if there aren't map drives or open handles or something that's sort of pinning the references in place, they would just naturally expire. So, cool. So the goal with respect to large buffer support is to see how we can improve protocol performance, specifically on very high-speed, low-latency networks like 10 gig E. There are also benefits in very high-speed, high-latency networks where people actually have like gigabit networks that are running over long ranges. But that wasn't as specific of the focus as it was to take advantage of the faster network cards. The other advantage of using larger buffers is that we can reduce some of the load on the storage stack, because for a single read or write request, we're only going to take one round trip all the way down to the disk and back up. And you could do that using the existing protocol, but you have to do some more complicated aggregation of I/O requests where you wait for all the reads to come in, you grow them to a larger read, issue them down, and then split them back up on the way up. And also, for some implementations, by doing larger reads or writes, we can improve the efficiency that hardware offloaded network drivers offer to us, because they have more opportunity to sort of take advantage of either DMAing or however else they might be accelerating those paths. Another goal for us is to sort of maintain the integrity of the crediting system. With the original SMB2 protocol specification, you could set your buffer size to say, hey, I allow 1 megabyte reads and writes. But essentially, every operation was equally weighted, which means someone doing a 1 byte read can just spend 1 credit, and someone doing a 1 megabyte read can just spend 1 credit. And the load taken up on the server there isn't equivalent in any means. So with Win 7, this actually came in the RC builds. There's a capability you can enable. It's disabled by default, but it's large MTU. And it basically indicates support for these large messages. So I've pulled some of the stuff out of the protocol definition. You can actually see where the capability bit would come across to negotiate time from the server response, as well as the larger values in the max transact, max read, and max write size. And this allows the server to control what the maximum buffer sizes there are. By default, if you enable this, we'll default to 1 megabyte buffer sizes. You could scale it higher, depending on, but most of it right now has been tuned towards 1 megabyte, at least in our implementation. But from a protocol perspective, there's no limit. If you wanted to do 100 megabyte reads or something, you could. So, yes?
I was just curious why you decided to disable the protocol.
It was more, like, for those of you who follow the documents, this wasn't in the beta update of the documents. So it was coming into the product a little bit later. And the other thing is we found that the benefits are mostly on 10 gigabit Ethernet or on, like I said, these very high latency but very high bandwidth connections, which are both uncommon scenarios in general. There's not a lot of us who are running 10 gig off of our desktops and this and that. So in general, since we were pulling in the feature a little bit late, we didn't want to force it on for everybody, but rather we're having people turn it on for scenarios where it's customized for. I would imagine that moving forward for us that we would want to turn this on by default. So, yes? There's a registry key. I don't actually have it in the slides, but we can find out and send out a mail on how you would actually enable it.
You can do it on Windows 8.R2 and Windows 7, right?
Yes, RC builds or later. Okay. So, yes. Yes? So that's what I was talking with Daryl about, too. So there wasn't a formal document drop for RC, so this would be the RTM drop of the docs, which should be aligned with the RTM dates. It looks like, well, actually, it definitely has to be out by the RTM time for obligations. Separate from that, it looks like it would most likely come in the July time frame. And I know that because we have received questions about, like, with this, where people see some of these frames either in captures and stuff, where there's specific questions. So,
I know it's not going to work out.
Yeah, so. Cool. So, specifically for operations, the large MTU capability is supported for the operations where we're actually exchanging buffers. So that would be for reads, writes, query or set infos, query directory, change notify, or IOCTL calls. And with respect to maintaining the integrity of the crediting system, when you're using large buffers, multiple contiguous credits are consumed in a single request or response. And basically, the size of the buffer divided by 64K is sort of set, since it was the previous max buffer size, as what a credit actually buys. Sorry. Yes. Yes. Yeah, so if you send 64K plus 1, you would need 2 credits. It's not rounded down. Right. So if a server isn't granting you credits, then you wouldn't be able to issue a large request. If the server's not granting you credits, the client would take that as an indication that the server is either under load or is low on resources. So it would seem like the server doesn't want you to send a 1 megabyte or a 5 megabyte read or write. He wants you to send him smaller operations. So.
Let's take a query example. I send the query as opposed to read and write is controlled by that transact size MTU thing.
Right. I see. So the question is, based on the max transact side and the negotiate, do you have to figure out how to get appropriate credits to issue a query info based on how the server's configured? Is that right?
You may be talking to a server that will never grant you enough credits to ever answer a query that's negotiated data.
Right. So for a query info, I can clarify, for query info or read, we can take query info, for example, the client's actually providing their output buffer size. So when I'm asking for an operation, if I say my output buffer size is less than 64K, I only have to consume 1 credit for that request. The only time I would need multiple credits is if I'm doing a query info and saying, yeah, give me up to 1 megabyte of data back in this query info. In that case, I need to actually supply 16 credits for it. So it would be true if there's query info fields that normally would exceed that 64K barrier, then those wouldn't be possible to execute without having multiple credits on hand. But those also wouldn't be possible to execute, at least over NetBT with SMB2 at all, because the maximum message size would be exceeded.
But the server isn't going to ramp down the size based on the minimum of credits and the query size. I mean, the query size is 2 meg. If you only have 1 meg worth of credits, it's not going to respond. 1 meg is going to reject it.
Yes. So, but for, I'm trying to think, for read, I guess it might be more interesting. For query info, I'd be curious if we see, of all the fields here, query info, set info are probably less likely to see direct benefits from large MTU because their sizes don't tend to exceed 64K unless you have a whole lot of streams on a file or something like that, for example. But like for query directory, if our client was to have 1 credit on hand, he would just do a single query directory asking for 64K, and when that came back, he'd have to do a subsequent query to do later. If he has 16 credits on hand, then he could do a single query directory for 1 megabyte. But the client is sizing the request based on the credits granted by the server. but he should always be able to at least make the minimum legitimate request.
What if the client is wrong? He's asking for one meg and only one query.
So if the client is asking for, the actual execution rules would remain the same as what they are, where if the client is trying to use a message ID with which they're not granted credits, the server would actually bounce the request. If the client sends 10 credits for a request that actually relies on 20, then the server would fail the request, and he would consume the 10, and you would assume grant them back again so that the client could reissue the request. So, yes? The server can choose the buffer size based on, sorry.
The max negotiated is 1 MB, and if it has credits, with which you can send only, say, half MB of the data, you can still choose to send half MB, right?
Yes, yes. It isn't that, like, if you can't fill the full buffer, like read is a common example, where if you ask for a 1 megabyte read, but the file's only 64K in length, then you would have sent requesting 16 credits so you could consume the whole read. You'd send 64K back, but you would still consume all 16 credits and grant them back to the client. Like, there is, the credits are always moving forward. There's never the case where you send it and the server says, hey, I didn't consume half your credits.
No,
sorry. Okay.
The server doesn't always do either 64 or 1 MB, right? It's
yes.
It does anything between that. Right?
Yes, sorry. Yes, you're correct. And the client as well. Like, if the client decides that it's optimized towards 256K, and it's not like the client has to choose between 64K or the maximum that we had on the negotiate. It's basically, it has to be underneath this, less than that. So. So the other notes on this, yeah, so server would reject requests that have insufficient credits, and likewise that all credits are consumed regardless of success or error. So just because you send enough credits to return 1 megabyte, if the thing fails because of an invalid parameter, you're still going to consume all the credits. So, and this is just a quick look at what performance is. These are preliminary numbers, but if we took the copy of a 2 gigabyte file, on 10 gig Ethernet tow-enabled system. Did I hit my mic? You can see how the copy time gets reduced by just enabling the large MTU. It doesn't quite double. You're more about a 30 to 40% gain, I think would probably be an accurate number. And over here, you're getting close to about 5 gigabit speeds on a 10 gigabit network.
Does it have any lasting impact if you have
packet loss, I mean, the packet loss, I'm not sure if the impact would be different with large MTU than with, like, not having large MTU enabled. It depends if TCP has to go to retransmit size. I don't know offhand how, if 10 gigabit would recover slower in some proportional way just because of the speeds or not. So, and eventually if you get to disconnects, then all the behaviors would exist as the same. There is some interesting logic in terms of writing your client under these conditions, because the amount of data that you can load in the pipeline is very large, and you can sort of get to these head-to-queue blocking scenarios where, you know, I'm doing a 2 gigabyte file, I have, you know, a ton of data set up to stream my writes over to the server, and now someone wants to, you know, get the attributes or query directory of a file, and that gets queued at the end of all the different files. So we've done some work in our implementation to do queue priority, where we do selection of what the appropriate request is and how much data will actually queue to the NIC before we queue more data, to sort of guarantee that metadata operations don't get blocked behind large data streams. That's mostly for user responsiveness. If you're in sort of an automated scenario where you're mostly scripts running, it's probably less interesting. So, yes. It's about 50% for 10 gig E. So I think, what's that?
It's a byte file, 7 seconds, bound.
Wait. Actually, sorry. Yeah, so it's a 2 gigabyte file. So it's 16 gigabits in 4 seconds. So you're right. I guess that's closer to 2.5. 25%, right? So there it is. So you're going from about 12 to 25%. There are aspects of the SMB protocol, at least that we've run into with being indicate and post, that make it harder to take advantage of hardware offloading and pre-posting receives. And without pre-posting receives in general, I think it would be difficult to hit theoretical speeds if you're actually writing the data to storage as opposed to just consuming it into memory and tossing it. Because that's the other side that we're limited here. I don't have the specific storage numbers here, but we're going to be limited by the storage back end because 2 gigabits on a 4 gigabit machine, we're not going to be able to cache all the reads and writes either. So we're going to get throttled by the disk. So. It would be interesting. Matthew, did you have a comment? So. And that
the copy was two sets of disks and then reads from one disk, set of disks, and then writes to the other. So it tends to be a
And that setup, though, we had a much faster controller on as well, the disk controller for us. So, I mean, there's definitely probably a lot in terms of can you be cached on both sizes so you don't have to hit the storage stack, and then once you have that, can you tune your network so that you always have data that's outstanding, but you're sort of avoiding, like, can you stay in the DMA path and avoid actual copies? There's lots of aspects, I guess, to tune it, and they would probably vary a fair amount based on implementation, too, I guess. So. And, yeah, I think definitely there is room for improvement with these numbers, but large MTU takes us from a worse place to a significantly better place, I guess is how we'd phrase it, but I wouldn't phrase it as the ideal place. I don't actually, yeah. I'd have to try and think. For us, with our copy performance, they're very different because with SMB2, we actually issue parallel 1 megabyte reads, which are then either segmented, or in this case with large MTU, they're not segmented, they're sent as individual ones, whereas for SMB1, as you guys might have seen with is it Vista or is it with Win7 now, where they split up to do 16, 32K reads and writes in parallel because they find that performance for some reason for smaller writes with SMB1 was better. So I don't know if when we scale to 10 gigabit, whether the SMB1 side of using a lot more smaller messages would actually show performance differences more or less. So that could be something interesting to analyze, and maybe we can find more information or whatever by like SDC time frame. See how they sit. Yeah, I think for us, reducing the trips through the storage stack was a big win. The other thing that we run into with the file system with SMB1, when you're doing writes specifically, is that since we allow writes to run in parallel, if the writes go out of order, you run into situations where the file system, if a later write comes before an earlier write, the file system has to take zeroing action to make sure there's not unwritten portions of the file that are accessible to the user. So large MTU solves this out of order just because the writes are much larger and there's much less chance of them passing each other in flight. So I would guess for our case that SMB1, just based on the zeroing issues that we've seen, would probably be slower than both of these. But that would be between two NT systems. I don't know for other implementations. So, cool. The other thing that's worth calling out is large MTU sort of enables us to grow some of our metadata caching sizes. So the Vista client will do directory caching, but it's sort of capped at 64K because that's what we get in sort of a round trip of open, query, directory, and close. If we actually grow this now to be 1 megabyte, then we estimate that instead of a directory of 300, 500 entries being retrieved in a single round trip in cache, we can do directories that would have 6,000 to 8,000 entries in general. So there's also been some logic done in the Win7 client to dynamically scale the size of our caches and the number of them so we can cache a little bit more data and we're a little bit more efficient than we were in Vista. And we also have some of our caching parameters that we're starting to expose because we found that for specific customers with different workloads, they can actually customize our caching values to meet their workload and see some pretty significant performance gains. So there was one customer where by increasing both the file not found cache lifetime and the cached handle counts and a couple other things, they could actually reduce their overall SMB2 traffic by about 70% for a targeted workload. That's probably a best case. If you're read-write bound, that's not likely to be it, but if you're very metadata heavy in your workload, there might be some real benefits to doing some of this analysis and customized tuning. So moving along, Vista introduced durable handles. As we sort of look back, there's been some positive responses. We haven't run into app compat issue concerns, which is one of the big things we were trying to avoid in the implementation. And we also, when we work with customers, we see traces that do show applications are recovering and continuing in cases where with SMB1 we would have actually encountered errors. But there are some issues that have arisen, one of which is that the SMB2 durable handle retry or reconnect used to be retry-based, where it would retry up to 5 times. But there were some cases where if the retry failed at the connect layer, that would actually be cached in a negative cache so that the subsequent retries just would never happen. And I know actually from discussions at previous Plugfest with some of you, you ran into cases where it looked like a durable handle reconnect was never issued, and this was probably a lot of what was there going on there. There's also, with durable handles, there's a reliance on oplocks such that these opens are subject to interference. If there's something like a backup engine or antivirus or whatever that decides to touch your open while it's there and breaks your batch oplock, that means that if you then take a disconnect, you're not going to see any gain. So it's still best case in effort, and it offers gains there, but if an application wanted stricter guarantees, if they actually wanted to have guarantees that after a disconnect they could come in with a given amount of time, we can't offer that with durable handles. And finally, if you're an idle application, the reconnect was based on the application issuing some sort of operation like a read or a write or a query info on it. So if your application is just sitting idle waiting for user input and you get disconnected, it's likely that your handle could actually time out before there's ever an operation that would signal the reconnect. So there was a fix for, or I should say a behavior change for durable handles in that now when we start reconnect paths, we will actually invalidate the negative cache to fix the issue that was being seen before, where you wouldn't see multiple attempts. Based on that, we're subject to the TCP connect timeout twice, which can be very long from an application perspective. So by default, we only retry twice. So you should be able to see both retries, which you wouldn't have seen previously, but it will only go through twice as opposed to the original plan, which was 5 times, just because apps would hang for about 2 minutes or more if the server was truly gone. But so one of the goals is how can we sort of build on durability? The idea here is that we want to be able to offer applications better guarantees that if the network was to go away or get disconnected, that they have some window of time which they can, their handle will be reestablished and their state will preserve, and they're not actually going to take an error. And so to make this happen, that would mean the system would have to be independent of oplock state, because we can't guarantee the oplock is not going to be broken if multiple people are going to try and open the file. And because of that, that means that any method we do here would not be transparent to other applications. So durable handles is sort of in this the most conservative method durable handles is, because if anyone else tries to open the file while I'm disconnected, it'll break the oplock and I'll let the handle go. So I guarantee the other guy's not going to fail the sharing violation. Once we say that holding of a disconnected open is independent of oplock state, there's a chance that an open by another client or an open local to the server could actually fail with sharing violation. So the concept that comes in with Win 7 is resiliency or resilient handles. And in this case, unlike durable handles where our redirector will just request it on behalf of the application because it has no interference with other opens, this would actually require the application to change to issue an explicit request. And what they're asking for is they're saying, if I go disconnected, then I want my handle held for this amount of time. And oplock breaks could actually happen while you're in a disconnected mode. This means that if I'm a non-exclusive open, then even if I'm granted a batch oplock, I need to flow my cached writes and my cached locks to the server, because if I'm disconnected and someone else tries to access the file, that would break the oplock, which would force a flow of cached writes and cached locks so that consistency can be maintained. For an exclusive open, you can continue to cache your writes and locks because other people will fail with sharing violation on the opens. So application specifies how long the handle would be held within bounds. And then on reconnect, it's the client's responsibility to replay operations in flight during disconnect. So this is actually the same as how durable handles work, but with resilient handles, because they're not tied to oplock state, it gets a little bit more interesting, which we'll talk about here. State-changing operations must be handled carefully, and we don't support this for named pipes because named pipes are sort of very explicit being like active communication. The server wants to get disconnect indications, and there's a various portions of RPC that wouldn't like us to try and implement this over it. So theoretically, you could attempt to do it for name pipes, but we didn't actually see value there. So, operation replay is sort of the interesting connection. For durable handles, it works because you sort of have operations which are replayable. These are ones that you can issue a second time, and whether or not they were processed the first time, it doesn't matter. The result of the second time will still hold. That would include a read targeted to an offset, a write within with specifying a target offset, a query info. If you go through the set infos, it's interesting to think through, but resetting allocation size to the same value is actually a valid operation. The success code would hold. Same is actually true for setting disposition for deletes or setting rename, because renaming specifies the target path name, which would be essentially a rename to yourself if you already processed it. And likewise, flush is redundant, because if you've already flushed it once, you're flushing it a second time. But it still holds that you can actually replay these operations without running into consistency issues. The two cases that sort of stick out are specifically appending writes. These are writes that are specified with an FFFF offset, where you don't know where they're going to go. If you replay that and it was already processed once, then you would actually double append to the file, which would be a violation. And locks and unlocks, because if you need to understand whether you've already succeeded in taking the lock to determine whether or not you should replay the lock again. Because if you try to lock the same range twice, you would actually fail on your own lock. And likewise, unlock, you could try and replay, but the success code would be incorrect, because when you unlocked it the second time, it would actually fail. The idea of replaying here is sort of dependent on a couple things that are noted over on the side, of one of which is in terms of synchronization between clients, the result of the operation is significant when the response is received. Which sounds like a sort of a pointless statement, but I guess what we're trying to convey there is if I issue the operation and it doesn't matter if it succeeds or fails, if I never get the response back. It's still indeterminate to me as a client. Really what matters is when I get the final response. So if I have to issue that operation a second time, as long as the success or failure code of the second operation is consistently correct, then the fact that I issued it twice is actually is fine. And the second side of it is that operations that are synchronized across multiple clients, this is where one client is issuing a write and then the other client's going to issue a read, they already have to be synchronized on completion. Essentially, the second client has to wait for the write on the first client to succeed before I can issue the read. Otherwise, there's a natural race condition there anyway. So the fact that the second client got disconnected, had to reestablish his handle and replay the write doesn't affect the fact that the first client actually has to block waiting for that to complete before they issue their read. So going towards a replay model where the client replays operation can help minimize server state preservation. We're trying to control how much data the server would actually have to maintain to provide resilient semantics. And as we can see, most of the operations do lend themselves to replayability. The question is, what do we do with the rest? There's one other one that is not up here, which is the IOCTL command. And that's interesting because it's almost on an individual basis for specific IOCTLs, whether they're replayable or not. Most of the ones we examined actually were replayable. But I can talk about that more offline if you guys are interested. So NFS has a pretty interesting response caching mechanism where you provide the buckets and stuff, and they hold on to the responses and send them back. For 2.1, it actually is using sequence numbers. These are separate from the message ID sequence numbers that are per open. The focus here is on locks. One of the things that we noted here is that appending writes using the negative one offsets aren't actually replayable. At least for Windows 7 clients, we don't actually send these forms of writes aren't used. They're actually all the writes are targeted to specific offsets with the client maintaining a file size. So currently, this system is implemented for locks, and it's designed for locks. The same theory can apply to other operations, so we can extend it moving forward. But with respect to what's going to be in Win 7 with the use of resilient handles, it's focused on making locks work. And if you're going to use appending writes, then the system would not actually apply. So the sequence number is per open. So every SMB2 file ID would have a sequence. The client actually provides the sequence number on a lock. And the operation result is cached on the server within a window of the most recent sequence numbers. And specifically, the interesting thing is that only the result needs to be cached, the success or the failure, not actually the full response. When the client reissues an operation, the sequence number would remain the same, and the server simply has to look up in his cache sequence whether the operation was previously processed, and if it was, if it succeeded. And if it succeeded, he can just turn around and send a success as if he had processed it locally. If the operations failed, you could technically cache the failures and do it the same way, but in the case of a lock that failed to acquire or an unlock, there's actually no harm in just replaying it and retrying to acquire the lock as well. So in our case, we don't actually cache failures. We only cache success codes. So the other side of resiliency that's interesting is reliable disconnect detection. Specifically, detecting disconnects becomes more important with resiliency, because if you can't detect them in a reasonable amount of time, there's two things that can happen. On the server, if the client went disconnected and the server doesn't know, then you're going to hold his handle around and cause sharing violations for longer than what the timeout specified by the application was. If the client doesn't realize that there's a disconnect from the server, then he could be missing out on this window of time where he's asked for the ability to come back in and reconnect and reestablish the handle. So there's a couple ways you can design around this. With the RC clients, what they'll actually do is they'll actually tune down the TCP keep-alive time to try and get faster detection on an idle connection if the other side is actually truly gone. If you don't want to use TCP keep-alive, so you could technically, as a client, you could use SMB2 echo request or something. Just something, or if you have constant traffic, then eventually TCP retransmits are going to make you aware of a client or server disconnect. So basically anything you can do to accelerate how quickly you can recognize a disconnect on both sides can try and reduce the potential failure codes that would occur as described here. So I put up a summary slide here if we wanted to look at the differences between resiliency versus durability. This is a lot of the stuff that was covered on the previous slides, but this is just sort of summarized. So resiliency is different from durability because it actually requires an explicit request from the application. On Windows, there's actually an I/O control code that would have to be issued providing the timeout. There's no applications right now that actually take advantage of this at this time. It guarantees reservation of the file regardless of op-lock state. This means that the op-lock break could occur on the server while I'm disconnected, and by the time I reconnect, the server would actually tell me, by the way, you're not at batch op-lock anymore, you're at level 2, you're at none, you're at something else. Our client will actually perform active reconnects for a resilient handle, which means the application could be completely idle, just sitting there doing absolutely nothing, but if a disconnect occurs, our client will actually actively try and reconnect the handle before the handle times out. Op-lock state can be lowered while disconnected. If you're a shared open, then even if the client has the ability, based on the op-lock level, to cache writes or to cache locks, those will be flowed to the server because we want the file to be in a consistent state while we're in a disconnect state, and we won't actually see the op-lock break while we're in the disconnect state. And from the server side, it requires waiting for basically until the timeout is exceeded, the handle won't be closed. Or else we need some other form of an explicit invalidation, such as an administrator calling the netfileclose API, or these handles would be held open basically for the entire timeout, which could cause sharing violations with other applications.
So David, what happened in the case of server reports, for example, only upload?
Right. So, with resiliency, there are no... It's still stateful in nature in the way that it's spec. So for a Win7 server on a cluster failover or server reboot, all the state is still lost. So it's targeted towards network failures between the client and the server as opposed to full server failures.
Okay.
So the
client will be notified they lost
the client. Yeah, the client would receive a disconnect. They would attempt to reopen it, and the reopen would actually fail because the server at that point has lost all state and isn't aware of it. Now, from the way the protocol specified, if you maintain like your file ID table, your lock state, and your replay cache and this and that across a persistent reboot, there's no reason from the server side, if you can keep that state present across a reboot, that you couldn't actually satisfy it or satisfy it on another cluster node or something like that.
Okay.
Because the client is still going to behave as if he's connecting to the same server and trying to reestablish the handle. So yes?
What's the interface for applications to request the resilient handle?
So there's an IO control code, so you have to call NTFS control file with a specific IO control code. I can probably hand it out to you. It's actually defined when you guys get the updated protocol doc, the FS control file, is called there. It's not spec'd on MSDN currently. And like I said, there's no applications aside from test applications, and we have a test filter driver as well that you can put it on if you want to see what applications would behave like with it. So, yes, the FS control that they issue as the application is the same one that is sent on the wire. So, oh, I don't have a diagram for processing. So for resiliency, this happens after create time. So after the create is set up and you either have durability or you don't have durability, you have an op lock, you don't have an op lock, you would actually see a FS control file go across the wire which says, I want to transition this guy to be a resilient handle or not.
And still support 2.1 but not resilience.
Yes, this isn't required. You could still fail the FS control call. So, yeah. Yes. So the question is, what's the application experience with resiliency during a disconnect? And that is actually, it's exactly what you said the first time, where the application issues a request down, and the redirector is going to hold that request and pend it while he reestablishes the connection and reestablishes the handle, and then he'll issue it out, and it'll complete after all that. Or if the reconnect attempts time out, then it would be completed with a failure. And that behavior actually doesn't differ between durability or resiliency. The only difference, yeah, sorry. So in our case, if we go back to the slide here, the only one, provided that the lock sequence is implementing, the only one that isn't replayable is appending writes. And our, like I said, we don't actually do true appending writes. We always do writes specifying target offset and length. So there aren't operations for the applications right now that would fail based on replayability not being allowed. So, yes, sorry. There's a rename, so, but rename with SMB2, as opposed to SMB1 where rename is entirely path-based, rename on SMB2 is handle-based, so you hold the handle, the source, you specify the target path, so replaying that is actually essentially renaming the file that was already renamed to the new name again, which is a no-op, and it will succeed, so. Yes? That's actually specified by the application. As part of the FSCTL request that they would issue down. So, sorry. Yeah, the test timeout is actually specified by the application so that way they can have some control within the bounds of how long it takes them to reestablish their state. Because there's definitely a trade-off here because the file is going to be held, and if the application never comes back, you could get other people failing with sharing violations that are unexpected. Whereas if the server times it out too quickly, then when the application does recover, his handles are already gone. So. Well, we don't do predicated operations right now. So you could issue a component information, which is a query info and then a set disposition. And then if you reissue those... So for a compounded set... So would a query for information on the handle that actually set the disposition to true fail with status file deleted, or would a query info on an alternate handle? I'd have to look at the FSBO semantics specifically. That's an interesting point, that there could be operations that aren't compoundable, like specifically set disposition information, with respect to replayability, because the order of execution could differ. So, in general, applications that are looking to do this tend to be more read-write data-based, where what they want is sort of reliable reading and writing as opposed to lots of metadata operations. Because likewise, this is within an open handle. This isn't across like query directories and other like metadata-heavy operations or lots of creates. It's an explicit step after create. So, yes? So you're saying, can the op lock, essentially the op lock would be broken, but you wouldn't actually reacquire it to a higher level?
No, so your client A has occurred op lock, batch op
log, and its connection has gone away.
Right.
Preserving the handle.
Right.
Meanwhile, client 2 comes and opens it. So you're basically tearing down the resilient handle or whatever.
Or you're acknowledging a break of the batch op block to level 2 or none or something like that. Is that?
No.
Okay.
Is this again open or be granted out of the norm when the handle is preserved?
If the handle is reserved, then essentially if the first handle has a batch op block and he goes disconnected, and now a second open is coming in, his attempt to open the file will break the batch op block on the first handle. So that'll break to either level 2 or none. And since you're in a disconnected mode, the server will allow that and basically acknowledge it. So we'll just say he's broken to level 2. And now the second open can request an op-lock level as if he would normally do, but he wouldn't be able to obtain a batch op-lock, for example, because there's multiple openers on the file. So the best he could do is level 2. Now when the first client reconnects, he's going to do a durable or resilient handle recreate, and the resulting op-lock level that would come back on that would specify level 2, which is an indication to the client that while he was in a disconnected state, his op-lock was downgraded. So.
So for the first client, if he had the exclusive op-lock initially, and he had some write failures because of the disconnect, he's going to replay those writes, right?
Yes.
So that's again going to break your level 2 also for the second time.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. So. Yes.
I suppose something I was wondering about just on SMB2 in general, but why does it actually revoke the disconnected? Because you've already got an offline break time on that. It seems like you could have easily said, hey, we'll give the original client this much time to reconnect before we actually just violate the
Yeah, I mean, and from an implementation perspective, as you're implementing the server, there's multiple paths you can choose. From our side, if the durable or if the resilient handle reconnect timeout, let's say that's 2 minutes, and then we know the op-lock timeout tends to be 35 seconds, so I could give the guy a 30-second window to come back, and that would be perfectly viable. The penalty I pay is whoever this other opener is, they're going to actually potentially stall for about those 30 seconds, and it's hard to judge the severity with whether it's better to stall that guy. What's more likely, that the guy who hasn't come back is still going to come back or not? Maybe giving him a 5-second window would be a pretty reasonable thing to do.
I mean,
so.
It seems reasonable.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And there's a lot around op-locks which is still sort of based on the premise that file sharing should be relatively rare, and that because of that, op-lock break should be rare. We know that's not necessarily the case, which is what we're about to come to.
I understand.
But
that's
yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and for our case, there's other interesting things purely from our implementation based on the, like, I guess it's true for, but we could have local applications as well that are processing. So like if it's your antivirus scanner and you're going through, then can I just pick a bunch of files and basically stall antivirus scanning sort of indefinitely by having it stall for 30 seconds on 1,000 files? That's an awful long time. So there are other concerns that you might want to take into account. But, yeah. That's sort of a good segmentation into changes to op-locks. So this is a slide just talking about, op-locks were opportunistic in nature, with the idea being everyone opens the file once, and that's it, and then they close it when they're done. What we know now is that applications don't do that, specifically either having multiple applications like Explorer trying to re-render icons and then Search trying to pull in content for searching while Office is reading the data, or even within Office when it's implemented in some sort of hierarchical fashion where they have a storage class and they instantiate it multiple times, so they end up opening the file multiple times. And you end up with a variety of cases where there's a single client but with a single user accessing a single file, issuing multiple opens that ends up breaking their op-lock levels and losing the ability to cache, and thus generating a lot more traffic on the network than is necessary. So one of the goals for Win 7 is to see what can be done to actually improve this. We want to enable enable op-lock state or caching state to persist across multiple opens from the same client. We want multiple clients to be able to take the equivalent of a handle caching op lock, so read and handle caching on the same file for publishing shares or read-only content. We want to allow the client to cache across all the different processes that are accessing the file, and we want to allow the client to upgrade their op lock or their leasing state as it becomes available. So the leasing updates were actually in the beta drop of the docs, I believe, so I don't know if you guys have had to do it. A chance to look at it. So some quick changes from between what leasing is and what op locks were is that now there's sort of a parameterized caching state. Instead of having batch and level 2 and exclusive and none, there's actually 3 bits for read caching, write caching, and handle caching. Write caching also implies lock caching because it implies exclusivity. Only one person could hold write caching on a file at any time, but multiple people can hold read caching or handle caching. So you can sort of look at it as in read-write handle is similar to what batch op-locks used to be. Read-write would have been an exclusive op-lock. Read is a level 2 op-lock. And read-handle is sort of a new mode, which says we're all reading from it. All of our opens are compatible, so you have the ability to cache your reads as well as to cache your handles. And then if someone comes around and tries to open the file that's going to cause, you know, going to fail with sharing violation, then I'll actually go back to multiple read-handle guys and revoke the handle caching bit and force them to flush out all their opens. But definitely for publication-style scenarios where everyone's opening in compatible ways, this can reduce the number of opens we see on the wire.
So you have multiple clients who are open of the same file. You're basically going to see only one open across the wire. After that, the open will be cached.
No, if you're going to see, this is more the case, like with the batch op lock today, if an app opened a text file and then the app actually closed the handle and then reopened it, if they had a batch op lock, the client could suppress, like basically delay the close and then reopen and match it. So that won't actually span multiple clients because the clients don't communicate directly with each other to exchange data. So, but you could have multiple clients who are all opening the same PDF file or whatever, and they all get read handle caching. So that means if the app that's accessing the PDF closes and opens the file multiple times, if you had a level 2, you would see all those closes and all those opens on the wire. This lets you see the, you know, basically we don't need to close and reopen it. We can delay the close and then use the existing open to satisfy the new open. So the leases themselves are key-based rather than handle-based, which means that as you're doing multiple opens, you're providing a lease key, which combined with your client ID sort of offers a key to identify this user's cache. And operations that are using the same key won't actually cause lease breaks. So this allows the case where if you have Explorer and Search and Office that are all trying to read the same file, even though you have 3 or 4 different handles, you can still have a cache and it can remain valid. You can still do write caching and handle caching and all those deals. So lease state is upgraded on create request, and then lease state is downgraded or broken whenever you would see a traditional op lock break. So, yes?
Can you describe, let's say, take the last one, RH?
Yep.
What assertions are true if RH is granted to you?
So, you mean from the client's perspective? So if you're granted R, the server can actually grant you RH at that moment in time because basically you have a compatible open, you're allowed read caching, so I'm going to give you handle caching as well if you asked for it. Now what will happen is if another open comes in, if that open would have failed with sharing violation, before I fail that open with sharing violation, I have to go to everyone I've granted handle caching to and I have to revoke it, just like I would have done with a batch op lock, so that if they have a delay closed file, then they'll actually close it instead of acknowledge it. And then if they all close it, then this new open might succeed where otherwise it would have failed. So you can view it as like it has the handle caching aspects of a batch op lock, but without the write caching, so it's not exclusive to a single client.
So this allows you to cache across closes.
Yes. It allows you to cache read-only handles that are shared across closes and reopens without causing sharing violations. So.
Across multiple
clients. Yes, across multiple clients. So. Cool. So on an actual create request, the client would provide a create context that offers the least key. There's some interesting discussion on why the client would provide the least key as opposed to why doesn't the server generate the least key based on uniqueness of the file. A lot of that's based on the fact that the client sort of knows what level that it caches at. A simple example is that you could actually have the file that's the same file on the server, but the client, since he's accessing it using a long name and a short name and the directory name, actually views them as two different files and sets up two different caches. So by allowing the client to specify the actual least key, he can set up the granularity of his cache, saying all these opens share the same cache and all these opens share the same cache, and they might actually be the same file, but since I have separate caches, I want to manage them separately. So theoretically, if you were implementing it, and if your cache didn't live in sort of a per-machine basis, but if it was per user or even per process, but for some reason you were actually sharing the same underlying connection, you could even do that, saying, well, I'm going to generate a new least key for the same file for each individual process because that's where my cache lives. So I don't know if that's applicable. I'm not as versed in how cache management's done on various client implementations. So. And then the server will provide your current least state as part of the create response. Least upgrades are allowed on creates. Least downgrades always take the form of an op-lock break because there could be operations that you have to acknowledge and flow out. So when a break occurs, then the client would actually generate the least break packet, and he would send it on any of the active connections associated with the lease. And then the client will acknowledge it, and the server has to permit the operations associated with flowing out a lease to complete during a lease break. This is just a note that says you can't block a write because a lease break is in progress, because you might need to complete the write to satisfy the lease break. The interesting one that was added here is creates, and that's the case where the client actually has a create issued going out over the wire the same time the lease break is coming back the other way. You can't decide that, well, I'm going to block this create waiting for a lease acknowledgement because if the lease keys match, the client locking might be, well, I have to finish my create before I know my lease state, before I can figure out what reads and writes I have to flush out and move along. So I actually put up an example if we want to sort of look at what a flow might look like here. So here we have an application, and he's going to issue an open request and that's going to cause the client to issue the actual create request over to the server, and he's going to request a read-write handle caching. Say someone else has the file open on the server, so server succeeds the create, but at a lower caching level than what the client requested. So he grants the client read handle caching. So on the left, you can sort of see, I use the box to specify sort of a lease boundary that's associated with the key, that there's one open now, and that lease is at a read handle state. So next up, the application actually issues a subsequent open. So he's opening the file a second time. And the client will actually identify that these guys should share the same lease key. So he issues the create over to the server using the existing lease key and specifying read-write handle caching. Server returns success. And at this point, the other client has, whatever was preventing write caching before has gone away, so that the client actually receives read-write handle. So he upgraded from read handle to read-write handle. It's important to note that the write caching is based on the lease. So that applies to both of these opens. So it's not just write caching on open 2, but open 1, which previously exists, now technically has the write caching capability. And then the application would receive their actual success code. So now if we take a lease break case, let's say that the application had closed open 1, but we had deferred sending the close because we had handled caching. And now something happens where someone else is accessing the file, which is causing a loss of handle caching. So the server will send the client a break from read-write handle down to read-write. The client will close the cached open, which is open 1, and then the client will issue an acknowledgement that they're now at read-write caching. So read-write is another interesting state because with most SMB, or specifically with our implementation, I don't know specifically, but you wouldn't break from batch to exclusive. If you ever took a break from batch, it was always to level 2, which was interesting because someone trying to open this who's going to fail the sharing violation because your handle's going to remain open causes you to lose write caching, which is sort of a shame to actually lose your write caching simply because someone else is attempting to open it, in which case they might even fail to open the file. So that's just to sort of draw attention to that too. This is a hypothetical example. Our clients won't actually send this on the wire with Win 7, but one of the questions is, well, what if I want to do a lease upgrade, but I don't actually want to open another handle? And you can actually do it with just a compounded create close for a get attribute open, requesting a read write handle lease. And essentially, if the create succeeds, you could upgrade from read write to read write handle if it's available, and then the close would immediately close it. And so open three sort of comes and goes in one big swoop. So if you wanted to, as a client, do a lease upgrade request, this is how you could do it using the compounding thing. And then the final case is application closes open two. Since I'm back up to read-write handle, I satisfy the application's close when I'm keeping the handle cached. And now the server or someone else tries to open the file, so they request us to break from read-write handle to read-write. And so now the client says, well, I don't need this anymore. So he issues a close of open two. And since it's the final close, that is an implicit acknowledgment, as it was with the original op-lock model, that, I'm done with the lease, and the lease is terminated. So are there any questions about the flow here? Definitely, if you have any questions or you want to talk later, you can just find me. I should be around all day today. So I just wanted to touch on the value of preventing op-lock breaks. So there's the obvious things where if we lose our op-locks, we can't cache our reads and writes, and we can't cache our handles. But there are some other things as we start to touch on some other Win 7 functionality changes that op-locks offer, specifically persistent caching. So like Vista and Windows 2000, they have the offline files ability where you can actually mark files for use offline. And if you end up taking a break to none, what we have to do is not only purge it from our local cache, but we actually purge it from the disk cache, which means at some point when sync runs, we're going to have to refill the file. Win 7 also offers transparent caching, which is this idea of, based on latency, I'm going to do persistent caching not for offline use, but just so that I can avoid issuing reads across the WAN link at all in the future. So it's sort of a second-level cache. And again, if I start taking op-lock breaks that cause me to lose read caching, I'm going to purge the persistent transparent cache as well. And then another thing is that this whole idea of transparent caching, or basically persistent caching, is sort of what the pure caching retrieval is based on for Win 7, and there's a talk on that tomorrow at 10:30, and I think Molly and Paul will be here as well if you have questions about that. But what this means is that if we can't find a way to make common applications like Office, you know, Word, opening a doc file, not break their own op-lock and end up, you know, down at no caching, then it's harder for us to get these other solutions to actually work. So, cool. So a few other miscellaneous small changes that went into Vista, one of which is on the SMB2 write command, there's a flag called the SMB2 write flag write through. This is specifically for unbuffered non-write through opens, and this allows you to tag individual writes as write through. It's similar to, or it basically maps to the foo a bit on storage. So an application could open a single unbuffered handle and issue writes that are either tagged with this operation or not tagged with this operation. So, and then the other one that we ran into is for interim responses on specific operations on Vista, we ran into cases with overloaded storage when we were trying to scale it, where our client would issue a long-running operation. This was specifically a very large extending write on overloaded storage, and get back an async response, and then the final operation wouldn't complete till 90 seconds later. So since that exceeded the SMB timeout, which was 60 seconds, we would actually disconnect before the operation completed, even though the server gave us the hint to say, hey, this is taking a heck of a long time. We're going to go async on this stuff. So our client behavior changed so that with Win 7, essentially the SMB timeout is quadrupled if you send an async indicator back. So that means if you know you have long-running operations, you can transition to async and turn the timeout by default from 60 to 240 seconds. Give you guys more time to finish stuff. So.
What is the unbuffered
handle? Oh, this one? That just means it's a handle that's opened with file flag no buffering. So if you're doing cached operations, there's also the cached, like if you don't specify that, it's a cached open, and in which case the write through, because cached write through is different than for us than unbuffered write through, which is a storage flag where we're showing things directly down the storage stack. So
okay, so you wait for the write to go through the disk before
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. That's what, so the intention of the FUA bit is that I could have it, and like if the disk allows like write caching on the storage on my unbuffered handle, if I don't specify write through in the open and I don't specify this flag on a write, then it could still be cached in the disk. Whereas if I specify this, then by definition you shouldn't return completion of the write until it's actually on the physical media. And this sort of gives applications the guarantees that that data, if like power is cut and everything else, data is made it to persistent storage. So I thought I might touch on just a few of the Win7 client behaviors, specifically ones that might have network visible behaviors. You guys are doing testing of server implementations. Transparent caching I sort of touched on, but that's just the idea that you can configure policy that based on latency will actually persist our cache to disk so that we can satisfy reads in the future. Pure cache retrieval and hosted cache, I believe they're talking about tomorrow at 10:30. Robocopy has a new multi-threaded switch, so you can actually, specifically for copying large sets of small files where copy tends to be metadata intensive as opposed to data intensive, there's some pretty interesting gains there. There's some changes to how our client requests credits in terms of when it's judging the available bandwidth on a connection to try and better scale up, since some of the throughput measurements you might get from the network stack might not actually be accurate, and you sort of have to probe the network. And also in copy scenarios, you'll see some compounded retrieval of metadata where we'll issue compounded operations to snap up various bits of metadata to reduce round trips on copy. I did throw in a quick chart here. This was just a little preliminary test just showing this is 50 64K files on 100 millisecond WAN link or whatever, just showing some of the benefits of multi-threading and robocopy for small files on how we can sort of scale the bandwidth. I didn't get the bandwidth number for the WAN link. That's the only thing I don't know, so I can't tell our actual utilization percentage. Usually utilization for lots of small files tended to be low because metadata accesses are synchronous, whereas for very big files we did a lot more in parallel and we can get much better utilization. So, yes?
That should add your performance of SMB1 as well, right?
Yes. Yeah, it definitely does because Otherwise, it used to be you do synchronous metadata, and then you might get some parallel on the reads writes. But for 64K, that's one round trip anyway, so everything became synchronous. So, so this should improve across the board. Two other things to touch on that are sort of unrelated. So, one of them is talking about FSCT, which was it's a capacity planning tool that lets you sort of scale up or basically evaluate the capacity of your server. Basically maximum number of users for server configurations. They talked about this at SDC last year. I think Bartosz did a talk on it as well. The big news is that the RC version was just released. It's up on Connect as of 5/29/2009, and the final RTM version is targeted for September of this year. So definitely if you're profiling your server implementations, you want to get an idea for capacity and stuff, check it out. And we have some Jane and Klaus in the back who can answer questions if you have any questions about it. And then the other tag is that Jim wanted me to throw in is that he's working towards setting up a reflector for discussing and designing Unix extensions for SMB2. He wants people to send him email so that they can be on the initial announcement. He said he would be here. I don't see him here, but he is somewhere. anyway, definitely if you guys are anyone who's interested in interacting with what Unix extension stuff, send Jim mail so that when he gets this thing set up, he knows where to send the invites and stuff. So, and that's all I have. So, any questions? Cool. Well, we'll be around this afternoon, and otherwise, if we're not here, you can ask Daryl where we are, or he knows where to get us if we're not here this week. So, and likewise, if you have questions on SMB1 or anything else, so. Yes.
So your release and locking is very similar to NFS 4.1 and et cetera. So do you communicate with them at all to see that you both go into the same direction or?
We don't actually interact with the NFS community to understand direction for NFS leasing versus SMB and stuff like that. And they don't communicate with us to get our input on where they're going either. We actually, for the longest time, we called it improved oplocks, and then we go to SDC and we see them present. We're like, oh yeah, this is leasing and stuff. So we just changed the name because they are very similar to the soft leases. So. But yeah, we don't have active communication with them. So.
I offered to put people together, but I didn't say that.
Cool. Sounds good. Thank you.